Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 18th of August 2018. The cover story called The Key to It All by Michael Brooks. Byline: could one multifaceted particle solve all the deepest problems in physics? Ask, I'm Michael Brooks. 911, it's an emergency. The most important particle in the universe is missing. Florian Gortez knows it isn't a case for the police, but he's still waiting impatiently for a response. The 911 isn't a phone number, but it's a building in the northern edge of the world's biggest particle accelerator. CERN, which operates a 27-kilometer-long Large Hadron Collider, LHC, running underneath France-Switzerland border, is best known for having confirmed the existence of the Higgs boson in July 2012. That was a big deal. Well, it's nothing compared with the particle Gertz wants to search for there. The Higgs solved the problem of how other fundamental particles get their mass. Gertz's baby would be capable of solving 5 outstanding problems in physics in one stroke. From the unexplained workings of subatomic particles, to the mystery of the origin of the universe, to the identity of the enigmatic dark matter that seems to be governing the workings of today. Quote, solving any of those problems would be considered a breakthrough worth a Nobel in physics, says Julia Zandighi, a particle theorist based in the University of Oxford. Too good to be true, perhaps, but Gertz isn't alone in pursuing it. From his office in the Max Planck Institute for Particle and Particle Physics in Heidelberg, Germany, he has been collaborating and competing with researchers around the world to describe its properties and predict just what it would be capable of doing. If they're right, the call from 911, where their predictions would be tested, would confirm the most important particle in the universe had been found. To understand why it's so significant, it first helps define what a particle is. Most of the time, we can get away with imagining particles as microscopic marbles jostling around in empty space or tied together inside solid stuff. If you want to understand their behaviour, however, this view needs to be abandoned. Instead, it would have better to think about a universe filled with fluctuating fields whose disturbances on a quantum scale manifest themselves in the form of particles or forces. Theorists conjecture fields in and out of existence all the time in order to solve one fundamental problem or another. However, because each one produces the particle, hard experimental evidence can only be provided by a particle detector. This was the case with the Higgs field and the associated Higgs boson. Okay. Thanks, Matt. All right. This is the case with the Higgs field and the associated Higgs boson originally proposed in 1964 to explain the short range of the weak nuclear force giving fundamental particles mass in the process. It took about 50 years before Higgs was found. In the meantime, more theoretical leaks sprang up, only physicists to plug them with hypothetical particles, some by the fistful. In the theory of supersymmetry, for example, every known particle was gifted a more massive partner, a doubling that was supposed to solve 3 problems in particle physics at once. It was perhaps unduly profligate. Signs of these supersymmetric particles were meant to turn up in the LHC after the first turned on in 2009, and then again after the upgrade in 2015. None have yet been spotted. Other theorists have come more parsimonious. In 2016, Guillaume Ballesteros, the University of Paris-Saclay in France, proposed solving 5 mysteries by adding 6 extra particles, a hypothesis known as SMASH. For Gertz and his collaborators, even this is too wasteful. Instead of drawing up lots of new particles, they say, what if some of those have already been theorized could be folded into one? It would be certainly reduce the theorists' embarrassment rather than admitting they couldn't find the whole slew of particles, they could only focus on the hunt for one. The result is a Swiss Army particle with an impressive range of tools geared to solve all manners of tricky problems. The first dates from 1977, when Robert Percy and Helen Quinn of Stanford University were confronting one of the most irritating problems in quantum chromodynamics, the theory that describes the interaction with protons and neutrons. It's called the charge parity, or the CP problem. It arises because the strong force, which occurs inside protons and neutrons, should violate a type of symmetry known as CP symmetry for certain situations. In fact, we haven't seen such violation, requires some explanations. And this thing on the importance of symmetry. Percy and Quinn's proposal to get around this was equivalent to introducing a new field that counteracts the unseen symmetry violation. In an attempt to confirm the field's existence, Nobel laureate William Wilczek discovered that, as with all quantum fields, that ripple vigorous enough, the new field created the potential for a particle called the Wilks, called the axion. The second problem in particle physics was emerging around the same time. Colin Foggett of the University of Glasgow, UK, and Holger Nielsen of the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen, Denmark, were grumbling about quarks, subatomic particles that band together to make up protons and neutrons, and hence all matters. There were six quarks, but very hugely in mass. The top quarks around 80,000 times that of an up quark. Quote, you just can't understand it. You'd expect all masses to be roughly the same. It says, go ahead. If things are very different in nature, you want to understand why there's such a large discrepancy. Foggett and Nielsen proposed what they dubbed a flavon field to solve the problem. This field introduces a symmetry that is broken in different ways by different quarks. The result in the quarks having highly varying masses, a prediction that matches the experimental result. So how can two seemingly different particles combine into one? The axion and the flavon. In the past couple of years, two groups of physicists have independently uncovered a cosmic coincidence. The particle produced by a flavon field has a component that looks a lot like an axion. Quote, it turns out that the axion is a component of the flavon field. It solves the CP problem. Says Gertz, meanwhile, the flavon simultaneously resolves the problem of quark masses. And there are more benefits to the marriage of the axion and flavon, as known as the axflavon or the flaxion, depending on who you speak to. Physicists puzzled by the large-scale structure of the universe have hypothesized since the 1970s that it went through a period of super-fast inflation soon after the Big Bang. Such expansion of space and time may be triggered by a particle known as the inflaton, which would have speculated has actually been which some have speculated actually is either an axion or flavon. What's more, the failure of the standard searches of dark matter has focused attention on the axion as an alternative dark matter candidate. Even this new axflavon guise, both uses are still on the table. If it wasn't enough, the axiflavon may have an additional superpower. Quote, we're working on a bigger unification, the axiflavon with the Higgs, said Gertz. It's a remarkable theoretical leap, but one that would have solved another fundamental problem. When the Higgs boson was discovered in LHC in 2012, it was lighter than many physicists were expecting. Theory says it should be a whopping 10 to the 19 gigavolts, but actually it weighed just 125 gigavolts. No one could explain the 17 orders of magnitude difference. But a suitably configured axiflavon might just keep the Higgs mass within bounds, a weight of many particle physicists' minds. I can wait on many physicists. In total, the axiflavon might be in a position to clean up five of the most troublesome problems in physics in one go. The unexpected conservation of CP symmetry in the strong force interaction, disparate masses of quarks, the sudden inflation of the universe, and the origin of dark matter, and surprisingly, light mass of the Higgs. Quote, it does seem to me remarkable that one can address so many outstanding problems of physics beyond the standard model with a simple framework, says Willick. It's thrilling stuff indeed, but for the moment it remains firmly in the realms of conjecture. The key to changing it lies with the building 911 home discerns NA62 experiment. Not well known as some of the site's bigger experiments, NA62 is nevertheless pursuing an important goal, improving our understanding of quarks by studying the decay of quark and antiquark pairs, which are mesons. The hope is that NA62 finds something unexpected in the energies of these decay products, hinting at what lies beyond the standard model of particle physics. Because the exon's properties, however, it could also pop into existence as an additional decay product in the process. The experiment, quote, is very related to the analysis performed of the Axiflavon search, says Babette Dorbich, one of NA62's experimenters. If it's enough to get Gert's curiosity excited, quote, it makes me optimistic that it's not impossible that we might find such a particle, he says. Fertile fields. When will we know for sure? Possibly soon. It depends exactly on how heavy the exoflavon is. Quote, the mass of the exoflavon is unknown, and thus the point at which it would show up if it exists is unclear, says Dorbich. If Gerhardt and his colleagues succeed in folding the Higgs particle into the exoflavon, however, the mass will be far more tightly constrained, and the experimenters will know almost exactly where to look for it. There are no guarantees. What fondness for multitasking particles is catching on. Researchers at Weizmann Institute of Science at Renville, Israel, have proposed their own Swiss Army particle in the form of a hierarchion, which can accomplish more or less the same tasks as the exoflavon by different means. All in all, it seems a fertile moment in particle physics. There is every reason to think that we will be on the verge of a breakthrough. Quote, it seems overwhelmingly likely that there's a new field out there still to be discovered, says physicist David Tong of the University of Cambridge. Quote, this seems plausible on the grounds of humility alone. Dark matter and inflation both strongly suggest we need something new. While the generation of theorists lets the imaginations run riot, the work of previous generations can reign in excesses. Quote, you can't just imagine a new particle and assume it will work out and solve your problems, says Baldiris. Quote, there are theoretical and experimental constraints that have to be satisfied. With a wealth of new ideas that turn many problems into one, it's exciting time to be a part of physics, says Goethez, especially since the little hut in CERN might find evidence at the end ends the emergency. Let's hope his call to 911 pays off. Next article, Our True Best Friend by Bob Holmes. Yeast helps make beer, bread and wine, but now we're teaching it some toothsome new tricks. And that's actually spelt toothsome. Florian Borer's recipe doesn't sound very wine-like. Take water, sugar, some amino acids and yeast, let it ferment. And yet, quote, when you smell it, you say, yes, that's wine. This is Boer, a wine scientist at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. Most people casually assume that wine's nose is all about the grapes, just as beer's flavour is all about the hops and barley. Not so. Much of the taste of these beverages comes from an organism too small to see with the naked eye. From the sugar-loving fungus, to be precise, wine should produce not just wine, beer and sake, but also bread and some of our most toothsome cheeses and more. So that's what he means by toothsome. Unwittingly at first, we have been domesticating and breeding this single-cell organism for millennium. The resulting legion of faithful servants can claim arguably more than any dog to humanity's best friend. We're talking about yeast, or more precisely, Strachlopomus crevasi, or brewer's or baker's yeast. But while the yeast's fermentive properties are well known, we are only now getting to grips with just how much it contributes to flavour. Our researchers prize open its secret. They are finding the newly, sometimes truly weird ways tickle tippers and gourmands' taste buds. Beer like banana milkshake, bread with a truly nutty crunch. With yeast, everything is possible. Quote, in terms of flavour, you can go as far as the mind can take you, says Jen Stenels, a molecular biologist at the Flemish Institute for Biotechnology, VIB, in Belgium. We have been fermenting stuff for thousands of years, but most of the time we knew nothing of the existence of the S. Cervece. Fermentation was something that happened almost magically. We now know it happens as yeast feeds on sugar, converting it into ethanol and the antioxidant people seek out in beer and wine, carbon dioxide and the gas that gives living bread its airiness. Brewers and bakers quickly learnt that they could speed the process up in an unfermented batch by adding a bit of the last brew as a starter dough. Over the centuries, this repeated nurturing has shaped the evolution of yeast strains that are finely tuned to the purpose. Beer yeasts adapt to a mix of sugars and fermented beer, and the ones that produce the pleasing flavour profile survive, prospered. Wine yeasts adapt to tolerate high alcohol levels and survive in nitrogen poor conditions typical of fermenting grapes. Cheese yeast present on the surface of cheese such as Brie and Lindberg during ripening evolved to use milk sugar, galactose and so on. Cats and dogs. The process is played out differently in each case. The artificial selection pressures on brewery meant beer yeast gradually lost traits that helped it survive in the wild. Most can no longer reproduce sexually or, for example, losing the most important strategy for coping with variable natural environments. But because wine is made only in autumn, wine yeast had to hide by their time on. Vegetation or winery equipment for the rest of the year. They have retained a more of their wild characteristics, including sexual reproduction. Beer yeast is more like dogs, and wine yeast are more like cats, says Stenzel. Cats can survive in the wild, but if you put a chihuahua in a jungle, it wouldn't survive. Stenzel was part of the team in 2016 to sequence the genomes of 157 strains of S. cervanci at Cara Visayi and built the family tree. They found there were separate branches for wild strains, wine yeast, and Asian sake yeast. Beer yeast did not occupy not one, but two branches, each with traces back to common ancestors just 500 years ago, about when the industrial brewing supplanted home brewing. Bread yeasts are partly mixed group, most closely related to the main beer group. Family tree plants a picture of a domesticated organism pumping our alcohol and carbon dioxide as its main job. Yet, as yet unpublished wine spoofing experiment shows, this is far from all yeasts do. Does. Most fruity flavors in wine come not from grapes, but from chemicals used called esters produced by yeast metabolism. So an ester is a carbon bond, oxygen's in there. Beer generally contains no fruits at all. Most of all its flavours, floral, banana, pear, whatsoever, come from yeast-derived esters. Yeast also account for a wide range of other small, volatile molecules which contribute to the aroma of the final product. Winemakers and increasingly brewers can select specific strains of yeast suppliers to achieve desired sensory profile of their finished product. If we know surprisingly little about why yeast bothers to make these volatiles, one theory is that they are accidental leftovers discarded as yeast produces cell membranes and other key materials. This unimportance would explain why different yeast strains for the same or the same strain under different environmental conditions can produce a very different mixtures of volatiles. There is an alternative explanation, and it comes from ripe fruit. Just as with beer and wine, many smells are commonly associated with fruit are not, in origin, fruity. If we leave a banana in my office, which is I often do. It's pretty obvious when I come on it Monday morning and there's a banana there, says Barnes, a yeast biologist at VTT Technical Research Centre in Finland. Quote, that's because yeast's contribution is not the banana itself. Those yeasty smells notoriously attract flies, and yeasts are relatively large, heavy microbes and cannot easily drift from host to host on the breeze. By producing sweet-smelling chemicals that might attract insects to hitch a ride on and can help disperse the yeast into new habitats. Oh, that's really interesting. Sure enough, in 2014, a team led by Kevin Vespini of VOP showed that volatiles, acrylic esters produced by yeast also attract insects. That same year, Matthew Gotthard, then a University of Auckland, New Zealand, and his colleagues showed that yeast strains more attracted fruit flies are most likely to be dispersed. But Gotthard remains unconvinced that most volatiles are for dispersal aids. If they were, every yeast strain would have evolved to produce an optimal mix, he says. Whatever the reason for making volatiles, the diversity is a boon for yeast breeders. In 2014, a brewery asked Verspin's team to develop a yeast that produced more of a man and pear esters like prize built and style beers. The researchers found that extracting yeast strains varied 30-fold in how much each ester were made. After picking three of the top producers and crossbreeding them, using some genetic tricks to ensure sexual reproduction, they quickly boosted the ester production of the best performing strains by 50%. Similar breeding programs could soon enhance the taste of two types of beer, but ultimately little bit of ciders, lagers, and non-alcoholic beers. Not every novel yeast needs a special breeding, however. Many are out there waiting to be found. Homebrewers along the western Norway fjords, for example, have been handing down their own yeast for generations. Genetic studies suggest that these Kevik yeasts are distinct from the main beer yeast lineage. They produce a distinct flavour profile that includes desirable tropical fruit notes and even intriguing as not yet fully characterised mushroom-like savour. I find them quite different from the other domestic yeasts, says Richard Priest, a microbiologist and co-founder of the Escarpment Laboratories, a company used based on Guelph, Canada. That markets Guelph, K-V-E-I-K, cake, and other regional yeasts to breweries. I can usually pick cake out of the herd, says Priest. Many winemakers travel this path already, fermenting their own wines with wild yeast that settle on grapes naturally. Since yeast flora varies from vineyard to vineyard, this contributes to the wine's territoire, the flavour of the place so prized by connoisseurs. Brewers of the Belgian Lambic beers claim the same for seasonal wild yeast at the Zen Valley. Bakers have fewer options. Specialty bakers often develop rich flavours in their loaves using sourdoughs fermented by whole communities of yeast and bacteria. But flavour diversity traditionally has not been as important in bread making. Even high-end bakers have no options for ordinary leavened loaves other than bog-standard bread yeast. Vesprin's research suggests that may be a missed opportunity. His team baked test loaves with 10 non-standard yeasts. Two Saccharomyces species and 8 species from another genera. Mostly they failed to leaven the bread enough or produce unpleasant and potentially toxic byproducts. Two species, however, champagne yeast, which is Saccharomyces baccus, got to be a three-way hybrid between S. sylvatica and two related species, the Turaspora debicki used to produce Chinese liquor, showed good leavening and unusually a subtle, nuttily fruity notes that tasters found pleasing. These yeasts could some days give commercial bakers new options, the researchers say. Over the centuries, we have done well in expanding the yeast repertoire of tricks. By exploiting its natural diversity and breeding of selecting strains with desirable traits, first accidentally and then on purpose, genetic methods are now upping the game. Vesperin, for example, has produced genetically modified yeast to make much of the banana-flavoured isomalt acetate that's resulting ale tastes more like banana milkshakes. That may sound yuck, but shows it's possible. As yet, no conventional brewers are keen to use GM yeast for reasons of consumer acceptability. Unleash the inner yeast. We can do similar things without cutting the DNA, though. When Christopher Curtin and colleagues at the Australian Wine Research Institute near Adelaide wanted a wine yeast that would contribute to the rose floral aromas, they noted that volatiles responsible were derived from amino acid phenylalanine. What they needed, therefore, were cells that produced phenylalanine more readily. So they added a toxic analog of phenylalanine to the yeast culture, figuring that the cells would keep making the amino acids instead of making up the toxin, would be more likely to survive. It worked. The strategy created several lineages of yeast with high activity mutations in two genes that were part of the metabolic pathway for making phenylalanine. The yeast produced up to 20 times more rose aromas and led to pleasingly floral wines. Quote, "It's a big impact on aromas," says Curtin, who is now at the Oregon State University. Yeast companies are already working to commercialize the new strains. And it is, in fact, just the start. Yeast may be only one of our listless pets, but its metabolism is complex. Breeding to flavour one pathway often has unexpected knock-on effect on others, and we don't yet understand enough to shape the entire flavour profiles in a predetermined, pleasing way. For the yeast whisperers, then, there is still much to achieve. Quote, "That's good," says Vesperin. "It stays a bit of an art." Seeking X article interview, seeking Earth's core in space. Lindy Elkins Talon is a leading mission to the only metal world in the solar system. Rosen Hopper hears how it could teach us about the heart of our own planets. Now, I thought that was only going to be a series. I thought it was a series. Let's have a look at it. The solid metal centre of the Earth is shrouded in mystery, or, more accurately, in 1,000 kilometres of molten metal and swirling magma. What's... No, so we correct that one. So everything we know, it must be inferred. It's sort of got a liquid outer core, then it's mantle has got the consistency of very heavy toothpaste. It would therefore give a study to the naked eye core directly. What would you give? The answer to NASA is the $850 million cost of a mission led by planetary scientist Lindy Elkins Talon, director of the Arizona State University School of Earth and Space Exploration. She's the only second woman to lead a NASA deep space mission. The date of the launch is 2022. The mission will venture to an extraordinary asteroid between Mars and Jupiter. I'm sure this is going to be serious, but we'll have a look. Oh no, it's a different one. Some 120 kilometers across, the asteroid 16 Psyche is unique in its seems to be composed of solid metal. Yeah, that's right. Ceres actually had some ice on it. It may represent an exposed core of a tiny planet that had its outer layers smashed away, says Elkins Townsend, who believes that it could tell us a lot more about the core and the formation of our own planet. It's likely the competition represents the ultimate fantasy for wannabe asteroid miners. Why go to Psyche is the first question. We want to learn about how the Earth is formed, but we can't get to the core to test our ideas. So we're going to a metal world. It's the only place in the solar system where we can directly observe the planetary core. I was surprised last year when NASA selected your project for funding as one of its Discovery-class missions. We were all pinching ourselves. We started competing against 27 other missions, we knew you had a really strong science case, so it's exciting to go to the first metal world. This usually don't get through step one of NASA's selection process the first time try, so it's crazy that we sent we went all the way. We backed all the friends, and now we're trying to prove that we're really worthy. How do you know Psyche is metal? P-S-C-H-E is metal. It's pretty darn sure from its radar albedo. It's a very high percentage of radar is reflected back by Psyche compared with other asteroids. We also know how quickly it heats up and cools. Its thermal inertia is 4 times higher than any other asteroids, so it really seems it's largely metal, if not completely metal. I think the result of a planetesimal being hit over and over again, with the solar system being formed and leaving only its core. When the Psyche spacecraft arrives in 2016, how will you tell whether the asteroid is a core or something else? We've got a lot of predictions for what it will look like if it's a core. To investigate, Psyche spacecraft is now being built. We'll have an imager and a magnetometer. And we'll also do an experiment to measure exactly how the gravity varies in the asteroid's surface, which will reveal composition and structure. But the key instrument is a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer, which tells us the elemental composition of the surface. Based on metal meteorites that fall on Earth, we think it's mainly iron and nickel, and that's what we think the Earth's core is too. But that's a lot of goodies mixed in, which makes the asteroid miners excited. Asteroid miners? At this point, I have to say, NASA reminds me the mission is about fundamental science and nothing to do with asteroid resources. That said, Psyche is mainly iron and nickel, but we also expect silver, gold, palladium, iridium and copper, not osmium, strange reasons. Okay. So the asteroid would be worth a lot. I calculated it for fun, and its metals marketed in January 2017, it would have been worth $10 quintillion. That's one followed by 19 zeros, a large number of Earth's gross domestic products, which is in the region of 100 trillion. But that's of course an irrelevant number, because if you brought it to the Earth, it wouldn't be worth it that anymore, and B, there's no way to bring it. It's a complete fantasy. Nevertheless, people want to exploit the resources and asteroids, right? We don't have an Elon Musk for asteroid mining, and there's no significant technology for it yet. But there's a huge amount of interest in a number of companies working on it, so I'm sure it will happen. I'm on the Hague Working Group for Space Resources at the University of Leiden in Netherlands. Right now, Luxembourg is positioning itself to bid for the European process of government, industry and law concerning asteroid mining. In terms of technology development, water on the moon is going to be the first target. The asteroid is going to be much more difficult. You mean extracting water from the moon? Yes. The ice water absorbed by the lunar minerals, that will be critical for future lunar settlements. The number of private consortia getting together to go to the moon, which seems attainable compared to Mars, means that people will attempt this. There's going to be problems, but people are going to succeed. How do you get into all this? I actually wanted to be a veterinarian until I realized animals hate veterinarians. Even at college, I wasn't sure I wanted to study biology or earth science, and I didn't have the confidence to go in for a PhD, so I went into business. I got married, had my son, then separated from my husband and became a maths teacher. At 31, I decided to go back to get my PhD. I was a single mother, and my son started kindergarten at the same time. You're basically to J.K. Rowling in planetary science, I guess. So in grad school, I studied half Earth and half Moon. I studied return samples from the Apollo missions, which I just adored. I made a model of how magma oceans could freeze and launch, that launched me into planetary science. And ultimately, planetary politics. Tell me about your interplanetary initiative that you started at ASU President Michael Crow. It's an effort to shape our future in space. I believe we're going to do a lot more space exploration, because it's human nature to explore space as opposed to go. The sheer fact that we can do it is miraculous, and the thing about space exploration that is almost uniquely inspiring to people, and an illustration of integrated society trying to do better. That's the Great Pool of Australia, Star Trek. What happens when Mars, there's an Elon Musk settlement right next to the settlement from China? Do they come as best allies to help each other survive, or does their allegiance remain to entities back on Earth? At least 7 radio minutes away. Can we figure out a better way for legal and social norms to go to the future with? I think we can. Polluter Pays? By Fred Pierce, and their byline is, a raft of lawsuits around the world are seeking to force action on climate change. Fred Pierce meets the plaintiffs. High school student Edgy Piper goes snowboarding in the mountains behind Seattle. But for now, for how much longer? He wonders. Milko Virgan fears her native Majuro Atoll in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific will soon be underwater. In Alaska, Nathan Baring's friends can no longer hunt for seals because the ice is too thin. 9-year-old Levi Dahan, who lives in low-lying coastal Florida, says to his residents, quote, it's scary having someone in the White House who doesn't believe in climate change. All 4 among 21 young people, self-described crime kids, who will head for district court in Eugene, Oregon in October. For several weeks, they will face off against the federal government lawyers. The plaintiffs will accuse the Trump administration and its only in America, predecessors for decades of deceit and wrongheadedness in handling climate change, and will seek an order compelling Washington to devise a plan to halt and reverse it. Suddenly, legal action over climate change is getting serious. The Humpty Skids case is one of a rash of challenges this year against governments and fossil fuel companies, in which citizens from various countries will try to get the legal systems to reboot our response to the most pressing global problem in our time. Gee, after a slow start, I'm beginning to read a bit better. Climate change litigation has been tried before with mixed results. 11 years ago, judges ruled that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency had a duty to regulate emission from motor vehicles following a lawsuit brought by the state of Massachusetts and 11 others. This opened the door for Obama administration aggressive climate policies. But in 2013, a court threw out a claim by the Alaskan coastal village that their big oil company should pay damages because the rising tides and melting ice were flooding residents out of their homes. Over in the Netherlands, a 2015 district court sided with 886 Dutch citizens who argued that the government had not exercised the duty of care to protect their environment from climate change. The ruling called on the government to make its emission reduction target more ambitious. The government has appealed the decision, and the final ruling is due on the 9th of October. With the 2015 Paris Agreement on a knife edge after the US announced it was pulling out, an increasing number of scientist activists are echoing the beliefs of the former NASA climate scientist James Hansen, who is advising the Climate Kids case. Hansen has called the judicial system the only way to get funds needed to deal with climate change because it bypasses the influence of lobbyists. US judges are paying attention. They have rejected attempts by the Obama and Trump administration to have Climate Kids case thrown out. One impact of the case is the momentum they would provide for more of the same. The Dutch success was the inspiration for Climate Kids action, says Julie Olsen, the chief attorney of NGOs called Our Children's Trust, that is a masterminding the case. Quote, want to be the catalyst not just as the plaintiffs in an American courtroom, but in the shifting ideals of priorities around the world, says Kirsty Julian, one of the young people suing the US government. She wants to shake up the debate on climate change just as the students caught up the Parkland, Florida shooting in February did the discussion on gun laws. Quote, it hasn't really. We have a moral authority and we want to cut out the government, pull out the government for neglecting its duty, she says. The Climate Kids case hangs on the public trust doctrine, which says the government holds the much protected certain natural resources like lakes and coastal waters in trust for its citizens. Olsen says this should apply to the atmosphere and stable climate too. She wants the court to uphold the doctrine by ordering the government to draw up a climate recovery plan. It would encompass a long list of environmental actions, withdrawing the rights to mine, drill fossil fuels on federal lands, in case of the workers, including those of the Arctic Ocean, ending federal permits for oil and gas pipelines and power plants, tightening the rules of car emissions, and restoring the US forests and soils so they can draw down some of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The case goes to court at the end of October and is expected to last 6 weeks, with a large range of scientists and experts called on to testify on both sides. There are more than 1,000 climate-centred court cases worldwide, according to the databases held by Sabin Center for Climate Change. Okay, I'm not going to read this. Now, I'm getting up to the time, but I've had to break due to tiredness, break several times. Law Court at Columbia University in New York and Grattan Research on Climate Change and Environments in London. The lawsuits can broadly be divided into two groups, depending on whether they seek government action or corporate reparations. Both are pursuing governments. Several have children and young adults as the plaintiffs. They claim that the political system has failed, leaving them with little choice but to go to court. Quote, I have been active politically for 5 years, lobbying and writing letters locally and nationally, organising in streets, but I am only 18, so I have never had a chance to vote. This is Baring. We're going to court to show that young people who are going to suffer for climate change much more than the elders must be listened to. Besides the US climate kids, there's Rehema Pardley, 11-year-old daughter of an Indian climate activist who is challenging her government's support for burning coal. In Colombia, early this year, court ruled in favour of an action brought by 25 young people who ordered the government to halt deforestation of the Amazon in order to stem global warming. Lawyers from the Global Legal Action Network, an environmental non-profit based in London, are supporting 6 Portuguese children affected by the country's worst ever forest fires last year in action against the European Union at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. In other cases, against governments, leans on the 2015 Paris Agreement. In the UK, a charity called Plan B brought an action calling for a review of climate policy, which says it's illegal. Tim Crossland, a barrister and director of Plan B, argues that although UK's 2008 Climate Change Act requires the national emissions to be cut by 80% by 2015, that is not good enough by the standards of the Paris Agreement, which envisages zero net global emission by the second half of the century to help limit the warming to 1.5 degrees. The case is backed by David King, who was a government chief scientist while the Act was being drafted. Quote, the scientific information has changed quite dramatically since 2008, said King. Our commitment should now be zero emissions by 2050. In July, Justice Superstone turned down the challenge, saying the Secretary of State's refusal to amend the target was not unlawful. Suing companies. Clubkins want more than Plan B. They say Paris targets are politically compromised. The lawsuit demands that the US lead the world by heading towards just 1% degree warming. Hansen says it will require cutting the atmospheric CO2 from the current 144 parts per million to 350. It's a level, it was the late 80s. Okay, how do you do? Litigants in other cases see government, I don't know how you can actually suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Let's go into reductions by reverse. Litigants in other cases see governments as pawns and corporations that mine, drill and ultimately burn most of the carbon that is warming the planet. Saul Lecano Lua, a Peruvian farmer and mountain guide, was to travel to Europe to challenge Germany's second largest power company, RWE. He is taking the company to court over a potential catastrophe high in the Andes. Lanao lives in Hawaii, a town of 120,000 people directly beneath the glacier at Lake Palachua, the region of the Andes where the glaciers are melting faster than anywhere on Earth. As a result, the lake's volume has grown 30-fold and more than 70 million cubic meters. Efforts to siphon off the water have failed. Dan McKinney's University, the University of Texas in Austin, who studied the situation in detail, says the landslide or ice fall into the lake will cause its contents to spill into the town below. Locarno's case against RWE is based on the recent research tracing rising CO2 levels to certain corporations. It began a 2014 study by Richard Heed of Climate Accountability Institute of Colorado, which found that most of the methane can be attributed to the production of just 90 companies. On that basis, Ernst says it's responsible for 0.4% of the total global emissions that are melting the glacier, and should contribute the same percentage to the cost of engineering work to make the town safe. RWE denies responsibility. In November last year, a regional court in Germany said the case should enter the evidence phase, meaning both sides have to collect evidence to assemble experts for the court hearings. No trial date has been set. A subsequent study by Heath and Miles at Allen University of Oxford found that six companies, including Chevron, ExxonMobility, responsibility for between 2 and 3% of the gases behind global warming. The study became the basis for the California cities of San Francisco and Oakland taking the five giant oil companies, Chevron, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Shell and BP, to court. The cities say that 2% responsibility for climate change should be warranted, a company paying 2% of the bill for protecting their contribution communities from rising sea levels in San Francisco Bay. Well, estimates by the Pacific Institute, a think tank in California, suggest that it's possible that 1.4-meter sea level along the state's coast by 2100 would threaten the property worth $100 billion, two-thirds of it in San Francisco Bay. Its report argued that oil companies should be liable for the impact of their products, just as tobacco companies were forced in the 1990s to pay $602 billion in settlements with smokers. The city's case drew a lot more of attention, but in June, Judge William Alsop ruled that the district courts were not in the right place to decide the matters. However, another California judge, Vince C.H. Abra, has sent comparable cases brought by San Mateo and Martin counties and the city's Imperial Beach to court at the state level. New York City is also engaged in a similar action that has yet to reach court. Quote, my impression is that all these fall down when you look at the courts are being asked to make public policy, says Allen. Fossil fuel companies, he says, can argue that society needed oil and gas and coal. They got richer in the last century. There's no way of producing and burning them without emitting CO2. That, however, could open up another legal avenue. The idea that CO2 could be captured from the power station exhaust and stored underground has been around for decades, but has not received any significant funding. Well, it's all stupid. If courts can establish that fossil fuel companies knew that carbon capture and storage technologies could be made, that they could have been investing in them. Quote, oh, that's a long way. Quote, if they'd done that, says Allen, we would now be able to maybe 10% of the carbon capture. Since fossil fuel companies' profits for the last 30 years have been pretty substantial, they wouldn't have had to invest a high percentage to kickstart global carbon capture industries. This is madness. One thing the court told to do to cause companies to get rid of CO2, says Allen. A critical question is how long governments and corporations have known about the threats to climate change. Several plaintiffs say that they found evidence that the bosses were aware of climate change consequences of their activities long ago, but denied it to put their investors, customers and wider public at ease, I suppose. In the case of Exxon, a 2017 study by Jeffrey Supran at Naomi Oaks of Harvey University suggested that the company's internal research tied its products to the climate change as early as 1977. When it comes to political awareness in Washington, D.C., an expert witness in the U.S. Climate Kids case will probably highlight the loss of innocence as dating back to 1965. That's when a report from President Johnson's Science Advisory Committee reported rising CO2 in the atmosphere, for which, quote, at least during the past, fossil fuel combustion has been the only significant source. The committee's environmental pollution panel has warmed by 2000. This increase, quote, may be sufficient to produce measurable and perhaps market change to climate. That could be deterrent to the point of view of human beings. One expert helping the kids, climate kids, Gus Smith, a senior environmental advisor to the President Jimmy Carter in the 70s, has reviewed the US government's climate policy over the past half century. Quote, federal government not only has set and stayed a course for major climate change, with terrible consequences to the endured, especially by present day young people and future generations, he says, calling this the greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic. Allen suggests the US may provide unique opportunity for litigators because it's abandoned the international climate process. An obvious defense for governments and corporations alike is that courts have no jurisdictions because the global community has taken up. Yes, hon? Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.